Hi, everybody. I'm Carla Pierre Fitzgerald, and this is The Imperfectionist, the podcast that proves you don't have to be perfect to live the life that you are proud of. In saying that about being trying to be perfect or imperfect, you're going to have to excuse my voice for my little intro here. I do seem to have caught another something off my tiny human, because that is what happens when you have tiny humans who are in Montessori. And we have just started into the summer struggle, the summer of trying to find somewhere for him to go for the days that he's not in his Montessori camp. But we're getting there sorted. I know I talked about this last week or the week before. But anyway, I did want to just bring to your guys' attention, if you haven't already heard about this, and I'm sure you have, but recently there a couple, Donna and Sans and her husband, they brought a case against the website Tattle Life. Now, on The Imperfectionist, I have spoken to many different influencers and people in the public eye about online trolling. And Tattle Life is basically a website where people were able to air their grievances, their issues, personal information, house addresses and things like that about people living in the public eye. Thanks to Donna and her husband Neil, they brought the case against Tattle Life because of the abuse that they experienced from the website, and they unmasked the owner and the person who created it. And in their such, there seems to be a change towards almost like a day of reckoning for people who've hidden behind keyboards for the last number of years, the last 10 years. And I know I've spoken to so many of my guests, like I know Laura the Glam Shamrock, we've spoken about it on and off the podcast as well, and how people are just hiding behind their anonymity. But the judge actually said there is a day of reckoning for both the owner of Tattle Life and for those who hide behind that anonymity. And I have to say, I was really touched by the work that they did, that Donna and Neil did. But also, I think it's just, it's a time where we have to stop focusing on the negative and stop airing and taking things out on random people that we don't know or people that we do know, and just think about things before we do them. And I hope that that is a lesson to anybody. And I hope that we can make the world just a little bit more of a positive place, or not even positive, just not negative. That would be just lovely. It would just be nice that we just not airing. There's enough crap going on in the world at the moment without people blasting other people and taking them down. So my many hats go off to Donna and Neil for all of the work that they did. I think it's absolutely brilliant, and they continue to do. And I know that they have some really big names behind them now as well, helping them. So hopefully we will get further along and there will be laws will be in place very soon. But today on the podcast, I am joined by Dr. Sabina Brennan. She is an Irish health psychologist, neuroscientist, author, and a former actress. And after earning her PhD in neuroscience in her 40s, she focused on researching on brain health and cognitive aging and dementia prevention, which is fantastic. She's also a best-selling author and host of the Superbrain podcast, known for making neuroscience accessible to everybody. She joined me and we explored the science behind self-talk, brain health, and self-belief, and how stories like that we tell ourselves, how they shape our lives. And you guys know that this is something that I talk about all the time, is like what we tell ourselves and how we can actually change that. And she talks about how neuroscience can help us to challenge those thoughts and the stories that we tell ourselves. So without further ado, guys, here is my chat with Dr. Sabina Brennan. Sabina, thank you so much for coming in to me. The first question I always ask guests is, what's something you used to tell yourself that you now know not to be true?
Right. Well, actually, I'm just looking at the name of your podcast, The Imperfectionist. Yeah, I suppose. But there was two things, actually. One would be, I grew up being a perfectionist and thinking that was a good thing. Mm. And I was rewarded for being a perfectionist in terms of, you know, my parents and school. And I remember the teacher would hold my copybook up and say, look how neat that is. It's absolutely perfect. She's, you know, she even dotted the one in 19, whatever, you know.
Yeah, and I relate to that so much.
Yeah, and I just, yeah, I've learned with maturity, and I suppose with my background now in psychology and neuroscientists, science that it's really not a good thing to be a perfectionist and it's not a healthy thing to be a perfectionist. Still hard to kind of get that idea out of your head, but I'm getting much better at it. And certainly when you kind of step back from it and look at it as a negative rather than a positive, it helps immensely kind of stepping away from that perfectionism.
Why do you feel that like being a perfectionist is a negative thing?
Well, you're always going to fail.
That's a very good point. You're setting yourself up for failure, really.
You are setting yourself up for failure because what is perfect, you know? And if you're a perfectionist, your standards of perfect are kind of higher and higher.
And keep going.
And they kind of keep going higher and higher. So, yeah, like even to the point I kind of, I remember saying to people, God, I feel like such a failure. And they're going, you feel like a failure? Oh my God, you did this, you've done that, you did the other, you did this. And I kind of go, yeah, but.
Or is that, would it be like something like the one little thing that went wrong you would focus on? Or would it be just that you didn't achieve everything?
Probably that I didn't achieve all that I imagined I would achieve. So I used to be an actor. But I dreamed of being like a famous Hollywood Oscar winning actor. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas I was an actor here on Irish TV and soap. You know, people go, oh, that's amazing. I'm going, nah, not really.
But it is amazing because there's so many people who would love to have done that.
Yeah, but that's the whole point of being a perfectionist is like that wasn't good enough. Do you know what I mean?
100%. It seems like good enough is something that a lot of us strive for. We are always looking for we're always looking for perfect, but we never strive for good enough.
Yeah.
What is good enough?
Good enough, you see, even when you say that, good enough.
Yeah, it's just
it feels like, oh, really? It's just good enough?
Yeah,
you know?
It's not amazing.
It's not perfect.
Yeah, it's not
perfect. It's not amazing. Yeah. So, yeah, I do think we're kind of, I don't know, maybe it's, maybe I'm being sexist, this thing, because actually I don't know the stats on this, but it seems to be more like a female thing. Yeah. And I think that has to do with, you know, how gendered our society is, you know, in terms of, you know, you've got to be, I mean, even those old phrases, you know, about girls having to be, you know, seen and not heard or, do you know?
And they last a lot longer than, you know, even if they're not something that we use in our lexicon today, they're still something that we were raised with, or it's something that we know that that's the terminology that we are aware of and it kind of sinks in.
Well, I think what it is that, you know, and I write about this actually quite a lot in my book, is that our brain creates our sense of self, of who we are. There is no unchanging eye behind the eyes. We have a sense that there is a self that is always there. But that sense of self is just created by your brain. And it's created by your brain from data that, you know, it has processed throughout your life. Now, a huge amount of the data used to create your sense of self comes from your childhood. And this is what I always say in the book, you know, you just got to take time out and sit down, make an appointment with yourself, examine your sense of self, all the things that you believe you are, and trace them back to where that came from. And a lot of the time you will find it came from like something one person said, maybe when you were 6 years old. Now, your brain has taken it in as important, relevant information, probably because it had some sort of emotional impact at the time. So I remember one thing when I was a child, and it's so funny, I can't recall what I did yesterday.
Yeah, but you can recall.
But I can really recall some of those things. And I remember I had a teacher, and as it happened, actually, she turned out to be a rather nasty teacher. She used to thump girls in the back, you know, for not being able to do their sums, like really. Anyway, she had two younger kids who they were in the baby school, we were in the senior school, they finished 1:15, we finished 1:15. So they used to come and sit in the class. Now, she actually lived on the road behind me, and I remember wanting to play with her daughters.
Yeah.
Maybe part of it was to be, you know, old friends with the teacher, kids kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe that's that kind of pleasing thing. And I remember them saying to me, oh, we're not allowed to play with you because you're just a notice box.
Ow.
Yeah. Yeah, that like really, really hurt. Yeah. And it's funny, like that happened. Actually, now I've just remembered something else happened with a maths teacher in school,
because she said at a parent-teacher meeting, I think, to my mum, you know, she's just really, she just, you know, kind of wants to be the centre, asking questions all the time. And I'm kind of going, no, I want to know the answers.
Is that not the point of education, is to learn, to
yeah.
ask the questions?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Expand your knowledge.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's funny. Yeah.
And they really do, those things really...
They kind of stick.
Did you feel that stick then through your life? Those
not consciously, those but you know, the point that I'm making is that they're unconsciously then taken into your... in by your brain.
Yeah.
You know, it could be, oh, you know, you'll never be good at maths, or you'll never make anything of yourself, or whatever. And your brain just takes that in. It was important information. And that just all connects with, you know, various other things that you've learned through experience or through your life. And that kind of becomes your sense of self. So the thing is, it's just a story that your brain has made up. So
it's actually like the narrative that you
it's
live
the narrative
by.
Yeah, it's like that you live by.
You get
yeah,
written.
Yeah. So the thing is, you can change that script anytime you want. You are the author of your own sense of who you are. Now, that's not doesn't mean you can go and pretend you're like an engineer or something yeah. like that. It's not about course. That. It's about, no, hold on a second. You know, am I really XYZ? You know, am I really a notice box? Or was that saying more about them?
Yeah.
Than me. And what happens if I actually follow that through and decide, oh God, I better not say anything, or, you know, I stop being
you.
Who I, yeah, yeah, kind of that genuine me, where actually then I, you know, I suppose as I got older, I kind of went, you know what, my life,
yeah.
going to ask the questions if people think that's what I'm doing. But I suppose it was always at the back of the head, oh, people think I only want to and be noticed.
And it does influence
yeah,
your,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Subconsciously.
But I think the more you become aware of those things, I think, and when I say that, you can change the story of you. Like, the longer something has been a pattern firing in your brain, the harder it will be to change. But it can be done. It really can be done.
It's
and
not
I wouldn't.
Impossible.
Yeah. And oh, no, gosh, it's very possible. But I also wouldn't try and change everything at once. Do you know what I mean? Kind of really kind of pick limiting beliefs
yeah.
and question them and kind of go, is that really true? Where did I get that from? Did I just then let that limit me so I never tried? And that's another thing as well about, and it's related to failure. It's related to this sense that, oh, I tried that once and I was no good at it.
Yeah.
You kind of go, again, you know,
it's the perfectionist.
Yeah.
Part, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm not in, it's like for me, I'm as a reformed perfectionist. It's like if I start a guitar and immediately wasn't, you
good
know, like Jimmy Page, I was like, well, I don't like, I'm not going to play the guitar anymore,
yeah.
which is ridiculous.
Yeah, no, absolutely ridiculous. Right. And again, it comes back to the, understanding how your brain works and how your brain learns. And really what we do is, we do this with kids, is if we're being kind of nurturing parents, we do, you know, we shape our behavior. So if you're trying to teach a kid how to score a goal, mm-hmm. you know, and they kick the ball and they miss, it goes wide. You don't say, oh, that's terrible. Look, give up the football. You go, okay, so that went over there. You need to move it a little closer to the
yeah.
goal. See if you hit it with a little, you know, whatever. But you don't say, oh, try and get it in the net now. Do you know what I mean? It's very gradual. It's like, okay, now you're closer to the goal. Oh, now you're closer. Okay, let's try again. Now it's in. What did you do that time? And that's the way it works, you know,
like
except for ourselves. It's shaping. It's called, like in psychology, it's called shaping behavior. That's how they train birds to do these complex things like, you know, press the blue button, twirl the such and such a knob,
yeah.
and then you'll get...
The treat or
the treat.
Yeah.
Now, the bird didn't learn how to do that instantly. It wasn't the first time. And actually, I think these people have the patience of yeah. I don't know what, because the way they shape a bird's behavior is so, you know, a minute fraction at a time. Basically, what they do is they reward if the button that they want, the blue button they want the bird to press first, is behind their head. If the bird turns their head slightly towards that direction, the bird gets a reward, gets another reward. And then the reward is withheld and the bird turns the head, but then actually learns, okay, maybe I need to turn it a bit further. And they turn the head a bit further and they get a reward. That is literally how they train them to do all those complex tasks. They shape the behaviour by rewarding something that the bird did okay. in the first instance that leads towards it.
And how does that translate then? So like for kids, it's obvious, you know, yeah. like kids, like we can do that as an adult. But then with ourselves, how do we do? Can well, we do you're that
learning
ourselves?
If you're learning guitar, like, yeah. you know, it really is, you know, well, hold on, let's shape this behavior. Am I holding it right? You know, and let's just focus on this chord. OK, that's not great. You know.
Yeah.
Let's try again. What do I need to change? Is it the pressure? Is it the, you know, and that is just how you learn. You keep adjusting your behavior. It not working the first time. Like failure is a really important part of the learning process. The problem is we see failure as an end result. It's not. Failure is a chance to get information to error correct. So that you can move to the next stage. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So failure is a really good thing. Without it, we can't learn. You know, you could get lucky, actually enough, and that's what it is. You could get lucky and get something right the first time. You go, oh, right, yeah. Keep doing that. yeah. But, you know, it is through something going wrong that you learn. And that is at the core of resilience is, you know, trying things and facing challenges in life and struggling with them, that then, you know, the trying is what actually builds your resilience to the next time
and
to be able.
And the overcoming the challenge.
And the overcoming the challenge ultimately, yes. Yeah. So I do think there's a thing like, and when we talk about children again, you know, where we kind of now are more likely to wrap them up in cotton wool and try and protect them from failure, giving all the kids a medal that don't win. I mean, you know, it's hard not to feel heartbroken, but, you know, for a child that hasn't won, but they'll be, if they learn that they didn't. Yeah, yeah. If you actually endorse the enjoyment of playing the support, the sport is what life is about. And that's the same, I think, for everything. It's the journey to the achieving that is really what living a good life is, as far as I'm concerned. Because when you achieve, that's great pleasure, but it plateaus.
It does.
It plateaus. And so ask anyone who's had a number one hit single, ask anyone who's won the lottery. It plateaus because that is our brain adapting. We are adaptive creatures. We can adapt to things that are bad and challenging, and we adapt to things that are really good. And that's why you've got to constantly keep setting goals and challenging yourself. Like that's, my book is The Neuroscience of Manifesting, but it's not about manifesting one goal. It's about learning how you can harness the power of your brain to attain multiple goals and to keep enjoyment in life.
It's so interesting you say that, because when you achieve something, like for a lot of us, especially perfectionists or like high achievers, when we achieve something then and we get it, we don't take any time to enjoy the outcome. It's just almost like a next. What's next? What are we going to do today?
Yeah, I think that's okay too. I mean, I don't mean the immediate what next. Mm. Of course, we should enjoy, enjoy and take time out. And celebrate, and that's important. But also as well, I mean, I remember my youngest son was a classical musician, and from very young, you know, he would have had that perfectionist tendency, which worked amazingly because he was a classical saxophonist. Oh, wow. And I never had to tell him to practice, you know, he could just, you know, he would just go and he would just keep at it and at it. And he learned, I don't know, the most amazing techniques. Like he could circular breathe. That means he didn't have to take a breath. Okay. Wow. My mind would be boggled. But I noticed with him something similar to me, because I used to act and perform as a child, not in a professional sense, but I did the fashion, you know, like people do piano, and I did exams and all that sort of thing. And you would work so hard up to a performance that then when it's over, you just get this real downer and feel really depressed. So I could see that starting to happen to my son. So I would just say to him, look, you're working towards this concert or whatever it would be, this recital. I said, I know that's your main focus, but you need to have something else that you're starting to focus on so that when that finishes, you can go straight into
the next.
Something else that will uplift your spirits rather than feeling. And I do think that, I mean, you know, retirement, doing nothing are just completely overrated.
Yeah. There's the main part that I like talk about, the main topic I talk about a lot is weight loss. It's because I lost over half my body weight. So
yes.
It's like, it's
oh my
a huge
goodness.
Part of my life. And I know that the
huge part of your life gone.
Literally half of me gone. Yeah. The odds of maintenance are always stacked against those of us who lose weight. And
yes.
I believe there's a number of reasons behind that. One being that we don't address the habits and behaviours that got us to be overweight. We just kind of white knuckle it through and then...
It's not even... Well, I like to think... I think you're saying behaviours in a narrow sense. I like to think of behaviours including your thinking, your beliefs,
oh, 100%.
Your acting.
Yes.
So I would say probably the strongest one of those is around the beliefs and the thinking
exactly.
processes.
And, exactly.
And actually, and emotional, your feeling. So your thinking, your acting, your feeling, your belief, because often it's something inside that.
Yeah. And overcoming those and looking at the source of them, like we were talking about before, like going back to the source and saying, OK, is this
do
true?
Do you mind if I ask? I know it's...
No, you're all right.
You're asking,
ask
but I'm always just curious about people. Were you a healthy weight as a child?
No, I was overweight from 5.
Oh, my goodness.
So I've had disordered eating since I was 5 years old.
Oh, my goodness. And any other members of your family?
All of them.
Okay. And your parents?
Yes.
Okay.
So it was all...
So you were trained to overeat?
I was trained to overeat. And it was that joy came from food, but also that being overweight wasn't a good thing.
Yeah.
So there was the combination of the two.
Within the family?
Within the family. And that was very confusing.
So you could all fail together. I think that's a kind of an interesting concept.
Okay.
Because that's one thing. And actually, it was misquoted on me in my very first book. And I was very annoyed about it. But in the book, the first book was 100 Days to a Younger Brain. So it's about keeping your brain healthy. And maintaining a healthy weight is very important from your brain perspective. A lot of people don't realize like a healthy cardiovascular system is absolutely critical.
It
your
makes
brain,
sense because it's
yeah, absolutely.
Your
brain needs, you know, and also what you eat matters because, you know, it's depending on you to provide it with nutrients and too much sugar is not going to be good. And actually obesity is associated with poorer memory function.
Oh.
Yes. And type 2 diabetes, it's as so many of the comorbidities as well, like midlife obesity increases your risk of developing dementia in later life. So like there's huge, huge links, you know, that people sort of often don't make. But in that book, it's 100 Days to a Younger Brain, and I go through all the various things, you know, that contribute to a healthy brain, and people kind of create their own little bespoke program through it. And in it, I'm talking about like whether it's, you know, you want to give up smoking or you want to exercise more or you want to eat more healthily. Well, then avoid, while you're trying to do that, avoid smokers, avoid people who are overeating, or avoid going out to dinner with somebody who's going to encourage you to have a dessert when you have resolved you don't want to have a dessert.
Yeah.
And I was actually, and it makes sense. That's what the science shows. You will, because people kind of like to fail together.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll do it if you do. Will you have another one?
It's the bad girl thing. Yeah, we'll
you know?
Do it.
And it's funny, I'm an ex-smoker for a very long time, but the one thing that I missed about being a smoker, and that's probably the reaction to being a perfectionist, was I missed being a bold girl going outside to have the cigarette.
It wasn't the cigarette. It was the
the cigarette.
Of course,
I mean, I was absolutely addicted to the cigarettes. But it was the bold girl thing that I kind of I miss being that girl. Now that was when I was older. Obviously, I was the little Miss Perfect girl when I was younger, and I had incredible discipline. You know, I would give up sweets for Lent. Absolutely no problem, you know, and I kind of laugh at my friends would say, oh, we break it up. We have chocolate on a Sunday. And I kind of go, then you're not giving it up for Lent. Like,
would you have considered them weak then if they had done that, or would it be?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Or that they're cheating.
Yeah.
That they're cheating. That's not the right way to do it. God, I haven't thought about things like that for years. But yeah, there is that thing of kind of let's fail together. Let's do that bold thing together. I'll have a dessert.
Yeah, it's actually it's something that I find when I speak to people about like when they're in weight loss, like, and if they get into a group, I'm very wary of the group mentality, because it's once one person goes off the rails, then it's almost like a, oh, well, you know, that's
permission.
It's permission.
It's permission. But the other way, the research shows that, like, if you want to exercise more, exercising in a group, you have a commitment to other people. You can also have fun and you combine it with other things that are good for you, like chatting to people. If you
and
go
the social
walking,
connection.
The social connection is kind of critical as well. But yeah, that's kind of, yeah, that's really, you know, interesting. It's hard for a child starting out with that kind of those kind of learned and trained behaviors.
Yeah, and it was something that was just that it was because this entire journey started because I had the realization that my negative self-talk didn't belong to me, that it wasn't mine.
Okay.
And it was really, it was persistent. It was 24/7. It was nothing I did mattered because of my weight.
Yeah.
And when I realized, hold on, that's not my voice. And I started to examine everything then.
Right.
And all of my life-limiting beliefs. And start to go, hold on, that's not, that doesn't come from me.
Yeah.
I didn't pick
well,
that
that's
up.
Exactly what I'm saying. You know, where did that come from? And, you know,
it was quite scary as well, because when you start to examine it, you're going, actually, who am I
who
then?
Am I?
And that was, it was quite painful to go, hold on, what do I know about myself? And I knew nothing.
Yeah. And you see, in a way, that's probably why I became an actor. I didn't know who I was. We had a mum who, since afterwards kind of have said, I think she had narcissistic personality disorder, but she really, her love was completely and utterly conditional, depending on how you behaved. So if you did something that she didn't like, she could actually not talk to you for several weeks.
Wow.
And, you know, you had to behave the way she wanted you to behave. And it was years later, my brother lived in the States and he went to therapy. And I said, why'd you go to therapy? You know, this was before I was a psychologist. And he said, I've no idea who I am. I have no idea who I am. And I kind of went, gosh. And that's probably why I loved acting. And I'm fascinated by, you know, the human condition, human behavior. And why do we do the things we do? You know, it's that exploration of trying to understand. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. And I think a lot of us carry from childhood a lot of those things. But then now, speaking as a mother, I'm pretty sure my kids have things, hang-ups and all sorts of stuff that I loaded on them. I wish they would say them though, because then I would have a chance. I do. I wish they would say them so that I have a chance to either explain or to sort of say, well, actually, no, that's the way you interpreted that, not the way it was intended. Or to say, I'm really sorry. And there's loads of things I'm really sorry about that I did when I was, you know, a young parent. None of us are perfect in that regard.
And we never will be. And we'll always make mistakes as
parents. It doesn't come with a manual. Like, it's hysterical. You know, you can't drive a car without driving lessons.
I always say you can't get a dog without a license.
Yeah.
You could have a child.
Oh, you've just reminded me. We just rescued another dog last week without a license.
Another rescue?
Yeah.
How many do you have?
I have three now. Oh, we had four last year and two passed away last year. So, yeah, we took in another one last week. But nobody wanted him. Oh, my God. Yeah. No, gorgeous little fella.
I'm glad you took him.
Yeah, we are. But I was just thinking, you were talking about the weight thing. So I'd always been a skinny kid, actually.
Yeah.
I wasn't an eater. And actually, I was talking to my friend about this a while ago. Like, I certainly was brought up with, you know, you can't leave the table till you finish your dinner. Now, that was obnoxious for me because I really didn't have a big appetite and I didn't like a lot of food.
Yeah.
I didn't mean in amount, but I was a fussy eater.
Yeah.
And now, we wouldn't have got a lot of food anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was, sweets were once a week if you did get them, kind of thing. But yeah, that's terrible to force our kids to finish their plate. That's
because it's ignoring your satiety.
It's, yes.
Like, it's ignoring your body of what
ignoring
it
your body.
Needs.
Yeah.
The
and
needs
what,
of your body.
What it actually needs. So then the only time I gained weight in my life was menopause.
That seems to be the.
Oh, it's horrific. It's horrific pattern. Because it hid who I was, and I found it very depressing, very, very depressing, I'll be honest. Because
menopause or the weight gain? With
the menopause? Weight gain. My menopause was pretty tough because I got hot flushes like every half hour, 24 hours a day, and dizziness with it and all sorts of stuff. But the weight gain didn't go away, and then we had COVID, and I learned to drink more than we would normally drink, do you know, that kind of way. So I would look in the mirror and just see this horrible fat person. And it just impacted on every single part of my life. And the thing is, I'd always been good that if I gained a few pounds, I could lose them easy. Not easy, but I could be really disciplined.
Because you're a disciplined person.
Just a disciplined person. Yeah. And I would say, OK, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to eat that. I'm going to exercise. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to go to the gym. And I would get back.
Yeah.
But that doesn't work in menopause. It just does not work. I tried everything under the sun, and sometimes even gained, like I gave up. Now I should say I've only recently lost the weight. So I gave up like alcohol for 2 months and ended up gaining weight because I kept saying, oh, maybe if I wasn't drinking, I wouldn't, you know, maybe it's the alcohol, because I wasn't even eating a lot.
Yeah.
Do you know? But then I thought, OK, well, if I give up the alcohol and then I mightn't snack late at night and all the rest, but I ended up gaining weight. So nothing was working. So you mentioned before we came on that your husband or partner is in AI. And so I just asked ChatGPT.
Yeah.
I just said, look, here's this. I, you know, never carried weight, you know, and I work on that, like 9.5 acres. I know I use a chainsaw. I strim, I mow 4 acres of lawns. Like I'm constantly moving and lifting things. And, you know, when I'm not sitting writing, I explained everything to ChatGPT. I had one other thing as well that I wanted to deal with, which was a terrible rash on my arms that I'd had since the time I first got COVID. Just this. I mean, I would tear my arms. One or two tiny bits kind of, you know, come in there. But I said, I want to deal with my menopausal weight. I would love to get rid of this rash. Yeah. I just want to get back to being me. And ChatGPT gave me a low histamine, anti-inflammatory, hormonal balancing diet sheet. And the weight has just fallen off. I've lost 11 kilos.
Wow.
In a couple of months.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's, and the rash is gone. Like that is incredible. Low histamine. I've been to dermatologists. I've had biopsies done on them. I have scarring. You kind of see different, you know, they were really bad. And I mean, it was horrific. I remember friends saying we were in the hot tub and they said, oh my God, if I saw you on the street, I'd say, oh my God, that poor woman, has she? Oh, like
bad.
It was really, really bad. And yes, so now I eat much more mindfully because I actually have got back to what was obviously as a child my set point. I was always busy doing something. I had to be reminded to eat.
Yeah.
And I would listen to my body because we'd be out playing and I would run in and I'd say, oh, I need to eat something. And I'd run in and say, Mum, can I have a slice of dry bread? And can I have one for the girls? That's that was our treat then, you know?
Yeah, just something quick.
Just something quick, a slice of dry bread. And so that's kind of what I'm back to. I eat when I'm hungry, and if I forget to eat, which I can do if I'm just caught up in doing something, I actually go, oh no, hold on, Sabina, you haven't eaten. You need to fuel your body and you need to fuel your brain. And so I go in and I think, what do I need? Okay, I need protein, and I actually haven't had any veg. So I need to have some vegetables. And so I actually eat for the purpose that we should all eat for, which is fuel. And the thing is, the hedonistic desire to eat is a way to encourage us to eat, because obviously some people can forget to eat. It sounds funny, but that's the way I was as a child. So eating has to be pleasurable. Eating activates the pleasure centers in your brain.
Yeah.
Releases dopamine. The main purpose of the dopamine releases, we talk about a dopamine hit and it feels good, but actually the main purpose of that dopamine hit is to motivate you to do it again. That was really good. Do that again so that we eat. You know, the same applies to thirst. The same applies to sex.
Or
that
drugs
was really good.
Or...
Yes. So then when it's drugs, yes, it's the dopamine that is reacting.
I know there's a lot of people at the moment are being diagnosed with ADHD as well, which can have a dopamine. It's like I don't know the correct terminology, but like their dopamine isn't correct, like their dopamine hits aren't correct, like that they're constantly searching for more dopamine, and a lot of people with ADHD are overweight.
Right. Oh, right.
So it's like it's an interesting link that you're saying that, because it's like trying to get something done repeatedly.
Yes.
Trying to do it repeatedly so that you can increase that feeling.
Yes, 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 yes. Yeah, yeah. No, it's really interesting. And it's very interesting when kids during our teen years, because our teen years are when our brain is going through from puberty to about 25. So we talk about the teenage brain, but it's really the adolescent through to young adult brain goes through a complete period of complete transformation. It is remodeled and rewired in those years. And the purpose of that is to make the brain more efficient. So basically, you know, brain cells and connections that haven't been used are kind of, they're deleted in a sense. So that's why it's really important, you know, for kids to have, you know, multiple avenues to challenge them or engage them or whatever. Neuroplasticity is enhanced in those years. Neuroplasticity is just a fancy word that explains the brain's ability to change with learning. It can rewire itself, and it's at the core of our adaptability as human beings. It's at the core of our evolution as a species, but our evolution as a person.
And is that linked then as well to that, like the sense of self, like the your neuroplasticity, that you can rewire yourself?
Yes, okay. That's exactly it. It's okay. Been wired. You know, neurons that fire together, that are wired together, you know, they fire together, and the more that neurons, if you talk about it in behavior, but the more that you engage in a particular behavior, the more likely you are to engage in that behavior, because it's got a really strong firing pattern. Okay,
so whether it be negative or positive,
it doesn't matter. Your brain does not make value judgments about your behavior.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, it does not make value jump. It does not make value judgments about habitual behavior, anything. And that's the key to understanding actually behavior change. So your brain's primary responsibility is to keep you alive. Okay, your brain is a high energy organ. It weighs about 2% of your body, but it consumes about 25% of the nutrients circulating in your body at any one time. So it uses a huge amount of energy. Okay, and it's
that way you're resting, like your basal metabolic rate is actually quite a lot of calories, because your brain needs it, even if you're not doing anything.
Your brain is doing something all the time. Your brain is doing a whole lot of work even when you're asleep. So basically, your brain, it uses a lot of energy. The part of the brain that we associate with being the brain, the crinkly outer part, that's the last part of the brain to have evolved. So actually, I'll just tell you. So the first part of your brain, the human brain, to have evolved was the brain stem, often called the reptilian brain. Okay. And, you know, if you've ever watched Eeyore or Casualty, you know that if you have an injury to that, you're absolutely screwed unless you're beside a life support machine. Okay, because it is responsible. It's an unconscious part of your brain, and it's responsible for your heart rate, your breathing, digestion, all those things that
bodily
are important
functions
to keep to keep you alive. The next part of the brain to evolve in humans is the limbic brain. You'd have to turn the brain upside down to see it. And it is often referred to as the emotional brain. So it is responsible for the fight or flight response, our emotions. Also, there's, you know, parts of it that are involved in memory. That's where our biases, our unconscious biases are seated. And the unconscious part is important again. The activity in that part of the brain is unconscious. So then the last part of the brain to evolve is the neocortex, for Neo. And that's what has evolved and got bigger and more complex in humans. And that's really what sets us apart from our closest relatives. It is the part of our brain. It's the thinking brain. It's the part of the brain that allows us engage in complex activities. The frontal lobes, then the front part of that neocortex, was the very last to evolve. And it's the very last to develop fully, when it's really not fully developed till we're about 25. And that is a part that's sort of like the executive controller of your brain. It's a really well connected area of your brain, and it constantly, it can sort of assess the big picture. And so it has the capacity.
Almost like you're the adult of you.
Actually the adulting part of your brain. And that's why I think it's really important actually for parents to continue being the adult. I really feel that right up until our young adulthood, we need someone with a fully developed prefrontal cortex to help us make right decisions. It's the part of your brain that assesses risk. And, you know, it's crazy. We've just decided, you know, that we're an adult at 18. One day you're not an adult, the next day you are. That's not true. Adult is a process of becoming through your brain, and it takes until about 25 for you to have that capacity to assess risk, to make decisions. And that's why so many kids end up, you know, doing silly things. And again, that's a classic thing of who you are. It's why I'm passionate about it. It is a book that I had wanted to write about the teenage brain, just to inform those of us who've been through it and those who are currently going through it, that you didn't have the capacity to assess risk. So that stupid thing that you did when you were 15 or 16 that you can't even think about because it turns your stomach. I have one. I've just thought of it in my head.
I have the same.
We have multiple ones. You got to forgive yourself. Your brain wasn't able to do it. Your brain couldn't assess that risk. And the brain is also really hungry for knowledge at that point of time, because it is in the process of becoming more efficient. And also your brain is kind of like a prediction machine. I know I'm throwing loads of information at you.
So your
brain is really like a prediction machine. That's the only way we can navigate the world. Again, it kind of sets us apart a little bit as humans, is we have the capacity to think of potential futures.
Yeah.
But your brain is constantly predicting what is happening next. Okay. And most of the time it's right, but it's making those predictions based on past experience.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the very simplest sense, you would think that the information you process goes straight into your brain and you're seeing reality in the millisecond or moment it's happening. But that's not true, because say if you look at two people, one person throwing a ball to another person, throwing a ball to you actually, and you have to catch that ball. By the time the information of that ball starting to be thrown actually makes its way through your senses and up into the part of the brain to process it, the ball is somewhere else.
Okay.
Okay? Because it's going to take a few milliseconds for that information to get in. So the ball is somewhere else. So your brain has to predict the trajectory of that ball based on past experience, based on learning as a child. You couldn't catch it. Throw a ball to a child first. They
can't catch it.
They can't catch it.
I was literally doing it to my son last night, 3 years old, and he couldn't catch it.
Well, I was actually trying to teach the new dog, because the other dog that's around his age catches the ball.
Yeah.
So I was trying to teach, and like, he's just going, you know, the paws
flailing.
Flailing. The paws are going everywhere. How do you do that? So it's because your brain, through experience and through learning, has learned to predict what will happen.
So almost like filling in the gap.
It is learning actually, but it's predicting. So that's the same with our learned behavior as well, in terms of our thinking and our beliefs. You know, oh, bad things always happen to me. Do you know? And so you enter this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy thing. But there's another thing that happens as well, in terms of, which is why your beliefs, your perspective about life are so critical to the kind of life that you have, because your brain is bombarded by billions of bits of sensory information. Mm. All the time. And brilliant as it is, it has not got the capacity to process all of that information. So its primary function, as I said earlier, is to keep you alive.
Yeah.
So the primary information your brain will always process, even with the eye, you know, like the eyes in the back of your head, is something that could be detrimental to your safety or your health.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, that will be the primary information it will process. After that, then it will process sort of unusual patterns, or, you know, something that's a little bit unusual, like, let's say, you know, a whole load of Jeeps with News Talk or Today FM or RTE on, and kind of go, oh, what's that? Because it's different.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it's different. And then after that, it will filter in information that is relevant to you, relevant or important. Now, how does the brain decide what's relevant and important? Well, your thinking and what you believe is what your brain will base that information on. So if you're think that bad things always happen to you, your brain is going to filter in information that reinforces that
makes
there's another bad thing. There's another bad thing. This is why good things happen to optimists. Okay. Good things happen to optimists. Optimists believe good things will happen, and the brain will pick in. There's a good thing. There's another good thing. There's another good thing. So your perspective matters. And attention. So that really is attention. So, you know, in terms of sort of the manifest, going back to my book, The Neuroscience of Manifesting. So the whole, you know, a lot of people in the manifesting sphere refer to the law of attraction.
Yeah.
You know, put it out there. It will come back to you. It is not attraction that brings success or those things into your life. It is attention. Focused attention. Because if you have your goal, if you've clarity around your goal and you know the end result you want, your brain is brilliant at solving what's called inverse problems. So in maths, that's when you were given the answer, you got to figure out how to get the working.
Yeah, okay.
So your brain is really good at that. Okay. So your brain will figure backwards, you know, what steps do I need to take? What action do I need to take in order to get to that goal?
Okay.
So that clarity. And then if you use some of the techniques that actually are grounded in science, like visualization and affirmations and vision boards isn't technically, but it's a reminder. It's keeping your brain on track. This is important.
So you are the reticular activating system?
Yeah. Well, actually, really what in a sense, what happens is when something is relevant and important, when you have a very clear message, when your brain has a very clear message about what is relevant and important, and in the sense of, you know, manifesting your dreams, that's your goal-directed behavior. What is important to attaining that? Anything important or relevant activates the salience network in your brain.
Okay.
And so that's important. Let's filter that in. So then you are presented with more possible opportunities. Yeah. You know, you see things. Focused attention is critical to success and sort of having that clarity and that plan. The thing is, what you focus on not only influences what you see and process. So you're not seeing an independent reality, okay? You are seeing a reality that is influenced by your behaviors, your beliefs, because your brain is just filtering in that information. So what you focus on not only influences what you will see, but whether you will see something at all. And that's really hard to understand. And the best way to understand that, it's called inattentional blindness. So if we are not paying attention or haven't primed our brain to pay attention to something, we will literally can be blind to something that is right in front of your face. Now, that seems impossible. Right,
but it doesn't, though.
Yeah, well, it kind of does. There's a brilliant experiment online, and you may have seen it, but this is what it explains is, and it's an old experiment, and just Google, you know, inattentional blindness if you want to look it up. But it's basically people are brought in to view a video of two groups of people, one in white t-shirts, one in black t-shirts, and they are throwing a ball back and forth to each other. The participants are instructed, they're standing in a corridor outside a lift, much like as you come in here.
Yeah.
And the participants in the study are instructed to count the number of times the team with the white t-shirts pass the ball.
Yeah.
Okay. And pretty much most people at the end of the study get the answer correct. And perfectionists definitely get the answer correct. And then when they're asked, but what about the gorilla? They say, what gorilla?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So literally during the video, the lift doors open, a person dressed in a gorilla suit gets out, punches their chest several times, looks right, looks left, exits the scene and is on screen for 9 full seconds.
Wow.
And the people who were so focused, and us perfectionists could be right focused on that, are completely blind to the gorilla. 50% of people who take that test.
50%?
Yeah. So,
wow.
The ADHers might actually have seen the gorilla.
They're more likely, but probably got the answer wrong then.
Well, you see, maybe not. But yeah, so with focused attention and having that clarity, you are more likely to achieve your goal. With attention that's not focused, it doesn't mean you can't succeed, but it means you can be lightly drawn off track.
Yes.
Do you know? Yeah. And not
distracted.
It's literally that.
Okay.
I mean, what manifesting just means to make things happen. And again, one of the other big myths that I aimed to bust in the book is that it's not a passive process. You know, you can't.
It's a very active.
It's a very active process. You can't, you know, think your dreams into being. You can't defy physics, but you can change your reality and your future, and you can achieve your goals. But that requires action. And
do you think people don't want to hear that?
Probably. Well, I mean, wouldn't it be? You see, I don't know. I was just about to say, wouldn't it be nice just to achieve your goals? But they actually wouldn't mean as much because you haven't
you
actually
action,
done
overcome
something.
The challenge.
Yeah,
the challenge, see, that, reward, challenge,
that,
reward.
That kind of goes back to what I'm talking about. The joy is in the doing. Yeah. Do you know? And again, because we're adaptive, that's why sort of being born rich doesn't seem as exciting to someone who's born rich, if you know what I mean,
because they already have it. It's familiar.
It is interesting. There was one, if I can remember it, one definition that I came across, which was manifesting is the process of gaining clarity about your goals through visualization and then developing discipline to stay focused on and take action towards those goals.
Makes sense.
You know, and visualizing is very important because it helps.
Why is visualizing?
Well, visualizing is important because it helps you figure out what the end goal is, what the answer is, so you can work back from that. Secondly, I think one really important purpose that it serves that you don't often hear about is that if you really do that detailed visualization that's manifesting gurus often talk about, and not just visualize, but, you know,
feel it.
Engage your other senses, how will that make you feel or whatever. Actually, that exploration can bring you to a realization that actually, don't know if I really want that. Mm. Or that, I use the example actually of, say someone wants to get a six pack, married woman wants to get a six pack, young kids, whatever, says, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to visualize this six pack. This is what I want to do. Okay. Then the figuring out how to do it involves, okay, doing research, whatever, following things. Okay. That would mean I would have to go to the gym every day and do XYZ core exercises for 45 minutes. Okay, hold on. I have a job. So I have my kids. Okay, where am I going to find that extra 45 minutes or 2 hours or whatever? Where am I going to find that to fit in? Okay, what can I move around and give up? I don't want to give up time with my kids. Mm-hmm. Can't give up time with my job. Well, I give up, but I don't see the girls 5 times a week. And then you kind of start to realize, oh, actually, I don't think I want this.
The process isn't worth.
The process. Yes, yes. I don't think so. What you can do then is adjust and go, OK, you know what? I think I'd just be happy with feeling a bit more trim. And I think I could figure out ways to go to the gym 3 times a week or to go for a walk. So I think that's a really important part of the visualization. And that happened to me actually when I was looking to move from Dublin down to the country. I had a very, very clear, I don't use vision boards or anything like that, but I'm an Excel queen. Just, you know, all the details of what that house had to have was in an Excel file. Yeah. It's just, I'm a very good visualizer. I love interior design and really enjoy doing that. But when it comes to, you know, step-by-step things that have to be done, that's an Excel sort of person or Google Docs, whatever. So I had my list and we found a house. And I wanted to be beside water. This had a view of Blessington Lakes. It was in Wicklow. It had a few things that weren't quite there, you know, but we saw it and we were excited. It was the first. It's very hard to find a house by water, actually. Yeah. There's not that many of them come up. And believe me, and you said this as well. I mean, I just love daft.ie.
Love a good search. Yeah.
Good looking. And yeah, you get so many ideas for interior design and the way other people live. Or, I mean, here's my perfectionist probably. How can people show their house and have their dirty laundry spilling out on the bathroom floor and have those photos put up on the internet? Like, judgmental. You see, that's another part of being perfectionist is it makes us very critical of other people because we expect other people to do things perfectly, and if they don't do it perfectly, you're holding them to a standard that's not fair. And you feel like they're not trying hard enough, or you can just misinterpret so many things. You know, that's another downside of perfectionism. So we put our basic deposit down, like not contract signing. We put we found the house in the May and they didn't want to sell till the September. So I had the whole, I literally was interior designing the house. I was knocking walls and a lovely little app on
the line.
I had the whole shebang, was working out what I would do and what I wouldn't do. And then I was visualizing, you know, I'm kind of going, oh, okay, it's at the foot of the Wicklow Mountains. We normally walked our dogs in St. Anne's Park where you can have them off lead. I'm kind of going, God, I won't be able to have them off lead. Yes, there's 2 acres. A garden was absolutely critical for me, but it's just two fields. I want trees.
Yeah.
I won't live long enough to see mature trees. And I was getting these niggles. Ooh, because I was visualizing and imagining living there instead of just that first thing of, oh my God, it takes this box, you know, it's going to be fine. The more I visualized, the more I got that sick feeling in my stomach. And again, though, another thing that I learned from that thing was, and something that I held about myself, is that I'm true to my word. If I say I will do something, I will do it. Now, that again is, I think, related to the perfectionism, you know. And I just felt, oh, no, I can't pull out. And I just felt I couldn't even say it out loud. And thankfully, they came to us in the first week in September and put a gun to our head and said, if you don't sign by Friday, we're out of the deal. And we said, we can't sign by Friday. We're still in the process of taking bids for our own house.
Yeah.
And that's not possible. You said you didn't want till the end of September. I think they got greedy because the market went up in value.
Of course, okay.
And at first my husband was, oh God. And I said, you know what? I'm a bit relieved. And the interesting thing then was, I said, right, I'm going to go back to the very first house I had seen, which was a few years before. This was kind of during COVID.
Yeah.
It was a few years before. The house was already sold when I saw it, but we had a beautiful house in Clontarf. Absolutely loved it. Thought I'd never leave it. But I said, I'm going to go back and read that article in the Irish Times about that. It was a house in Wicklow also, but it was by the lake and it was just beautiful. It was already sold and actually probably beyond our budget at the time. And I said, I'm going to read that again just to remind myself why we want to move and what we want to do and to just get rid of this feeling that, you know, we've wasted like 5 months kind of on a house or whatever. And when I read that article, I looked at the bottom and it said, here's another house you might like, because the algorithm had been looking at what I'd been looking at over previous months, etc. Knew I wanted houses by the sea. Okay, yes, this house was by a lake or by water or whatever. And it's the house I bought. And it was the house of my dreams. Absolute house of my dreams. It was $250,000 more than we could afford. And my husband said, I'm not going to see a house we can't afford. And I said, Dave, I have to see it. I have to see it. It is my dream home. It has my gardens. It has everything. I actually realised also we were underselling ourselves in the other one. Okay. I wasn't dreaming big enough.
Yeah,
I was saying, oh, look, we got a few of the lake, that'll tick that box. Now we actually have 400 metres of lakefront. I can walk down from my garden and get into a kayak and go kayaking. My dream home. And anyway, we went to see it and the man wasn't moving. We knew we couldn't go up to that. We weren't going to be getting a mortgage or whatever. Anyway, I just kept visiting the house and asking him about the grounds and the gardens, and I knew he loved them very much. And long story short, he was going to take the house off the market, and we went in with a bid that we could afford, and it was the first time he thought about it over a weekend. Anyway, he actually had at one point offered to give us the $250,000 as a loan.
Oh, no way.
How that would work. He didn't need the money,
but
I knew he had a certain amount in his head that he wanted to get over. And he said, right, okay. He said, I'm going to sell that house only because that woman loves that garden so much. And I know that she's going to look after all the work that I've done on it. So there's more than one way to skin a cat. Do you know what I mean? I didn't go try looking for $250,000 because I know we didn't want to have
a mortgage like that.
And I knew we wouldn't get it. And it wasn't why we were moving. We were moving to get closer to nature. And I had been working 16, 17 hours a day. And I just wanted to get more balance in my life and spend more time in nature. But we made it happen by knowing what we wanted and actually being prepared to say with the other one, you know, revisit and go, actually, you know what? That's not quite right. And
I think
that's
almost like that was the failure that allowed you know, like failing was okay.
Yeah,
Like,
well,
it wasn't a failure, but it was a learning.
The big learning curve for me on that was, actually, do you know what? This thing that I have in my head that I should always be true to my word is not always going to serve me well.
Yeah.
You know? And that was a big learning one, actually, for me, because I was
I think I was just brought up that way.
Yeah.
You know, if you say you'll do something, you have to do it. And I did that to my kids too. And I actually feel bad about some of those instances where I say, no, you said you have to do that, you have to do that. And now I go, oh God, I was so cruel.
But we all, like, as every parent I know is probably listening going, oh, don't we all make mistakes and do that?
Yeah.
But that's, I think, part of being a parent, though, isn't it?
Mm.
Sabina, we have a closing tradition on the podcast. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and could talk to you for the next 2 hours, but unfortunately somebody else is going to come into the studio and take over. But we have a little closing tradition of our Rolodex. So we spin the Rolodex. You tell me when to stop and I ask you a couple of quick fire questions.
Oh, okay.
Okay with you? You let me know when to stop.
Okay, go for it.
What's your favourite holiday destination?
Where I live, my home feels
a holiday. I think that's like
I suppose my holiday destination is going out into my garden and down to the lake. I mean, that's
perfect.
Perfect.
I keep going
then. I do it again. Okay, stop.
What's the first thing you do in the morning?
I'm very bold. I pick up my laptop or my phone and check my emails.
I'd say you're not the only person who does that.
I tell people, do not.
I love it. We'll go for one more, Sabina. Tell me when to stop.
Stop.
What's your favourite quote?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if it's a quote, but it's something that I think is really important. And it's, great things happen when lots of people do little things.
Oh, I love that.
I just think about, I don't know whether I made that up or not, but it's just something I've been thinking about a lot lately, given the political environment and what's happening in the world. And, you know, without getting political, that's the thing. We feel we have no power, but if lots of people do little things, you can affect change. Because I think in the face of big disasters, in the face of, you know, questionable politics, etc., we can feel very stressed by it and powerless.
Mm.
But we can all do something small. And if enough of us do that,
we can make change. Fantastic. Sabina, thank you so much for coming in and sharing so much with us. I think I'd love to have you back. If people want to find out more about you or get your books, or if they want to come and stay in your gorgeous holiday retreat, where can they find you?
So they will find me. I'm on Instagram at Sabina Brennan. I have a website, sabinabrennan.ie, which is currently going under refurbishment, but there is a site there. And our lovely holiday cottages are loughsillenhouse.com, and it's a real retreat. It is, people come and they just go, oh my God, I've never felt so chilled, because it's just the birds and the water. And it's just, it really is just a...
I will be coming and
booking. Little slice of paradise. Yes,
it looks perfect. Guys, I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. I know when I mentioned that I had Dr. Sabina Brennan on, a lot of you were really interested in hearing what the conversation was going to go like. So I hope it lived up to your expectations. And thank you again so much to her for joining me and sharing so much of her knowledge with us. So if you love this conversation, please, guys, make sure you hit the follow button, leave a review, and share it with somebody that you think might benefit from it, especially any of those people who talk about or have issues with life-limiting beliefs and the stories that we tell ourselves. Make sure you're following us on Instagram at The Imperfectionist Pod. And until next time, guys, keep showing up for yourselves.